Very good to see such interest in our work, and I look forward to a lively discussion session in a little while's time. Thanks, CEDA, for hosting the event. CEDA's played a big role in providing fora for important public policy discussion for a long period of time, for 30 years. I've been addressing from time to time CEDA events about economic developments in Asia, Australian inflation and productivity performance, many other issues, a range of trade issues. This is the first time I've been here on climate change. I've been on a steep learning curve over the last year, and I'm grateful for the many Australians who have been working in this field long enough to give us good foundations to work on. Today, I'm going to talk about a particular part of our work, our suggestions for design of an emissions trading scheme. We've now put two major discussion documents into the community. One was our interim report in February. That had its origins in a promise by the now Prime Minister some months ago that in addition to bringing out a draft report in the middle of this year the final report at the end of September, we'd give the community a view on our thinking along the way through with an interim report early in the year. The origin of a discussion paper on an emissions trading scheme now rather than mid-year is that the government has a very tight timetable for introduction of an ETS. It's aiming to have it operating in 2010, and so we thought that getting views, proposals, suggestions out for public discussion early would be helpful to the whole policy-making process. So the ETS discussion paper was released last Thursday. That gave you all a vista to read it, so I probably need not spend a lot of time on the detail. But I'll spend a little bit of time on the detail. An emissions trading scheme, an ETS, I'll use the shorthand because I'll use the term quite a lot, will be the centrepiece of Australia's climate change mitigation policies. As David mentioned, and as the CEDA discussion of climate change last year revealed, there are other approaches. Quite a lot of economists like the idea of a carbon tax because it's simple, straightforward, don't have lots of dead-end arguments about free allocation of permits, less corruptible more generally. But there are some advantages in an ETS. If you get it right, if you have a transparent, clean system, then trade in permits to emit can get the rights to emit into the hands of economic agents for whom it's most valuable, and that has the effect of reducing their costs of mitigation. If a government is firmly committed to reaching emissions reduction targets, then an emission trading scheme can achieve those targets more reliably than a carbon tax, where you would have to experiment with the rate over time before you achieve the right calibration, and you might have to continually adjust it. So for those reasons, a good ETS, I think, has advantages over a carbon tax, although I would be the first to agree that a carbon tax would be better than a corrupted ETS. But that debate's behind us, I think. The Australian polity has committed itself to an ETS. It did that before the last election. The previous government, Commonwealth government, was headed towards introduction of an ETS. The current government has confirmed that view. Reduction in emissions, in greenhouse gas emissions, is going to be a major reform. It's going to be a costly reform. The cost will turn out to be manageable if we do it right, and our design proposals for an ETS are about getting it right. In the work on design principles with the secretariat I work with, based at first in the States, based in Melbourne, and now with the Commonwealth component, we focused on first principles. There are lots of ideas doing the rounds on elements of design of an ETS. We've got a number of examples of operating emissions trading schemes around the world, including one of the world's first, perhaps the world's first, in New South Wales with the GGAS scheme. Had the experiments in Europe over the last few years. But we didn't want to start the analysis in the middle. We wanted to start with first principles, and the design proposals in our discussion paper reflect that. The review's model for an ETS is forward-looking. The aim is to minimise the cost of Australia's adjustment to a low-emissions economy. We recognise that the value of Australian mitigation will depend on what other countries do. Australia's effort is only fruitful as part of a global effort, and so the design principles have to be cognizant of the conditions that will be most helpful to promoting an effective global agreement. We recognise that the world is groping its way towards an emissions reduction strategy and approach, that there's a reasonable likelihood that over time, perhaps unfortunately over a long period of time, we will see the emergence of something of a global trading scheme in emissions permits, so that we want what we do in Australia to not only be helpful in the emergence of an effective global mitigation regime, but to be able to link to that so as to reduce costs of abatement. We see the discussion paper as the beginning of a discussion, this large gathering today is a very important part of that. The discussion will shape our final recommendations in the main reports. The single most important principle guiding the ETS design is simplicity. We think that's important because comprehension of how it works, transparency in how it works, is going to be very important to the credibility of the scheme. Simplicity is also likely to be associated with efficiency, especially with the minimisation of the inevitable transactions costs associated with such a scheme. Credibility is essential to ETS design. Participants in the market and in our polity must form the view that the arrangements that are put in place are here to stay. If there is continued doubt, continued lack of credibility in the scheme, that's going to increase transactions costs, raise the supply price of investment, inhibit the investment that's going to be necessary to achieve efficiently the transition to the low emissions economy. I'd like to say a little bit about the starting point of the ETS, and that is setting the limits on emissions. we could see this as being, well, we should see this as being extrinsic to the design of the ETS itself. Government will set the emissions targets or limits, and it will do that with a lot of considerations in mind. Once the targets have been set, the role of the ETS is to minimise the cost of reaching those targets. But the starting point of the scheme is the setting of a long-term budget and a firm emissions trajectory. No domestic decision made by Australia in the area of climate change mitigation will have greater international ramifications than the choice of Australia's emissions budget, and it obviously will also be crucial in determining the cost of mitigation in Australia. I just want to put on the screen one slide to illustrate a particular point about targets for emissions reductions. And I hope I understand how this works. Yes. It's common for targets for emissions reductions to be expressed in terms of reducing emissions by a certain percentage by a certain point in time. For example, in the current government's policy, there's a target of reducing emissions from 2000 levels by 60% by 2050. And so if our current emissions are there, a reduction of 60% by 2050 could be indicated by the orange dot. But we could get to that target with a number of different trajectories. We could increase emissions quite a lot for a while and then bring them down rather sharply. Or we could get to that target through a much more gradual process. Well, what matters for global warming is the total amount of emissions that go up into the atmosphere, so that the trajectory that involves a big increase for a while and then a sharp reduction will be associated with the release of far more emissions into the atmosphere than a flatter trajectory that moves more directly to the target. That's a very important distinction. Most of the policy discussion, not only in Australia but in the world, is focused on targets at some points in time. But it's the area under the curve defining how you get to the target, that actually matters for climate mitigation. So we'd like to think about a budget for greenhouse gases. There's a certain total amount of emissions, the area under the curve that the world can afford to put into the atmosphere if we are to avoid risks of dangerous climate change. And we should be thinking of that as we set our objectives for emissions reduction. Now, increasingly, in addition to long-term targets, governments are identifying intermediate targets. For example, there's a strong focus now in the European Union and in the international discussion on a 2020 target. Well, that somewhat constrains the path by which you get to a long-term target, but it still has the problem that you're looking at particular points of time. It's the area under the curve that's crucial for climate. As we discussed at some length in our interim report in February, there are strategic as well as domestic policy considerations why, when government sets a target, it should set more than one emissions budget. In the interim report, I suggested that Australia should have an emissions budget to which we are prepared to commit unilaterally in the absence of comprehensive global agreements, and then more ambitious targets that we're prepared to move towards in the context of a comprehensive international agreement. In the ETS paper, we present in a stylized way a way of looking at the multiple budgets. We will commence the ETS beginning in 2010 within an already committed Kyoto target. The Kyoto targets become internationally legally binding following our acceptance of the Kyoto Treaty in December. That commits us to holding emissions to 108% of 1990 levels on average over the period 2008 to 2012. We're pretty close to that now. It's often said that that we're easily going to meet those targets. It actually won't be all that easy, but that is the target that we have agreed internationally for the period up to 2012. There'll then be a very important question: what targets should we set for the period beyond that? And there's much international discussion. There was tense discussion at Bali about targets for the period 2012 to 2020. And we're going to have to make decisions on that in time to give certainty, structure to the putting in place of our own ETS in 2010. That will be a decision before we have seen all of the current post-Kyoto negotiations play themselves out. It will be before a new US president has had time to change American policy on these things. Change we will get, but the details of that will emerge through 2009-2010. We will need to take a view on 2008 to 2020, upon which we build the initial phase of our own ETS, before we have all that information. And we suggested that the guiding principle should be we should do something comparable with other developed countries. Europe's given one lead. We will need to form an assessment what others are doing. Then we might think of another more ambitious trajectory committed over a longer period of time that we would be prepared to commit to in the context of all developed countries making firm commitments. And there the big unknown is the United States. And we'll learn a lot about United States policy over the next year or two. But we would suggest locking in to a trajectory towards minus 60% by 2050 once it's clear of the shape of developed country commitments. But the interim report emphasised very strongly that there will be no solution to the global warming problem without major and early commitments by developing countries. All of the momentum, not all, most of the momentum in increases in emissions is now from the rapidly growing developing countries. The international discussions and feelings of around the world of justice taking into account historical responsibility have led for very strong pressures for developed countries to take the first step. But there will be no solution to the problem unless the major developing countries enter firm commitments on constraining emissions growth pretty soon. We think that it's in Australia's interest to encourage that and to put on the table the stronger commitments to emissions reduction that we would be prepared to enter if we do get the commitments that the world needs from the major developing countries. And so then you would have another trajectory D. Each of these are purely stylized. Don't try to work out interim targets from them. We've got a lot of work going on the actual numbers, and you'll see the results of that in our draft report in the middle of the year and in elaborate detail in the final report in September. But that gives you an idea of how we're approaching the issue. Our scheme, once you have the targets and budgets, is a very simple one. We suggest that the scheme should be administered by an independent regulatory authority. We've given it the name the Independent Carbon Bank. Others will be able to think of better names. But the role of the independent authority will be to divide the trajectory into permits by established international precedent. There'll be permits allowing the emission of a tonne of carbon dioxide equivalent. The sum of the permits will be will equal the trajectories. We would have in mind a regular auctioning or a regular competitive process distributing the permits, a competitive process organised by the Independent Carbon Bank. You would begin the auction process in advance of the beginning of the scheme so that decisions... So the market would begin to form a forward price curve, give guidance on price discovery. Companies that need the permits could start to get themselves set with the permits that they need. And then you would put the permits into the market on a regular basis. It could be a weekly competitive process or a fortnightly or a monthly. Each year you would allocate into the market the number of permits corresponding to the emissions level on the trajectory for that year. The Independent Carbon Bank would manage this process. It would monitor and enforce compliance for permit acquittal. It would be a crime to emit carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases without a permit, the regulatory authority would monitor and enforce compliance of permit acquittal. It would also administer something that we think is essential for the environmental and economic integrity of the scheme, and that is transitional payments to trade-exposed emissions-intensive industry pending the introduction in competitor countries of comparable carbon pricing arrangements. The Independent Carbon Bank would administer that and make permits from the revenue that it receives. The Independent Carbon Authority would also have capacities to lend permits requiring repayment so that over time they were enforcing the trajectories that were established by law. Permits were issued into the market, there would be no time limit on their use, except that permits issued for a particular period couldn't be used before that period, but they could be used at any time after that. There's been a fair bit of discussion of the rationale for auctioning the permits. We think that a competitive process offers very important benefits over free allocation, benefits of transparency, simplicity and credibility. Free allocation will be highly complex, generate high transactions costs and require value-based judgments, and would inevitably be the focus of intense political activity. Both economic theory and the European experience teach us that whether permits are allocated freely or auctioned, the price impacts through electricity and other prices on households will be the same. The point is sometimes made that if you give free permits to established generators, they will not need to price in the effect of the cost of the permit into the price of electricity. But that permit has a scarcity value whether or not the person who owns it has paid for it, and the owner of the permit will be able to extract value from that in the market. The analogy might be an inheritance of a house. The fact that you get it for free that will not affect your rental behaviour, the price that you charge for rent, or if you sell the house, the price at which you will sell the house. The free allocation would be what economists call a lump sum transfer. It affects the distribution of income, but does not affect decisions on pricing or investment. One important design feature of our scheme, consistent with simplicity, is that we don't think there should be price caps or floors. We think that the market should determine the price. The market will form a view of the price of permits that's necessary to force the structural change that has the economy living within the legislated trajectories. And if you put a cap on that, then you don't reach your targets. Obviously, the mitigation costs will be lower, but you haven't met your environmental objectives. We think that the flexibility that some think we need to have through price caps can be achieved in a way that's consistent with environmental objectives through the intertemporal variation in the use of permits, through lending of permits from the independent regulatory authority under conditions under which they must be repaid. We think that setting up a system like this would probably introduce a fairly strong tendency in the early stages for the hoarding of permits, especially if the trajectory turns out to be a steep one, a trajectory that's informed by comprehensive global commitment to effective mitigation objectives. In those circumstances where we start with a relatively light emissions reduction target, but there's high expectation that the budget will be tightening over time, in those circumstances it's likely that that some people will buy permits with a view to holding them and using them later when the game gets tougher. And so there's quite likely to be a tendency to what is called bank permits in that early stages. It's not inevitably the case. There may be some market participants who look forward to a great technological breakthrough a bit later, who think it's better to borrow permits that are prepared to back financially their view that mitigation will get easier over time, and to use permits more readily now. There's a very important question: how the large amounts of revenue that will be generated from a sale of permits are used. In the modelling exercises that will be reported in the draft and full reports, we will talk about this in some detail. But the amount of revenue will be very large by almost any standard, but they will be limited and there will be many claims on them. And these claims have been discussed in detail in our interim report. They will include, the claims will include, first of all, the payments to trade-exposed emissions-intensive industries. And we see this as an intrinsic feature of the scheme, necessary for environmental and economic reasons, hopefully becoming less important over time as other countries adopt carbon pricing. Much of the permit revenue will have been received by government simply as a transfer from households, at least in the early stages. Most of the value of the permit will have been, most of the cost of the permit will have been passed through to households, for example, in the electricity sector, probably a complete transfer in the petroleum pricing sector. There's no doubt that this in itself would put burdens on households and costly burdens, difficult burdens on low-income households. So we're suggesting that part of the valid claim on the revenue would be tax, social security, energy efficiency reforms that would assist the adjustment of low-income households, a big topic in itself. There will be demands, as there is under any major structural change associated with reform, for support for heavily affected communities. There is a possibility that the coal-based energy producing regions of Australia, and we've got some big ones in New South Wales, Hunter Valley, the Illawarra, will be particularly damaged by this change to emissions pricing. That may not be the case, and everything depends on whether the current activity in research, development and commercialisation of new technologies for carbon capture and storage is successful. I myself see good prospects for this, and within our review we're having a lot of work done on this. And certainly there's a strong case for use of some structural adjustment funds preemptively to accelerate the evaluation of these technologies. There's also a case on public goods grounds, standard public finance grounds, for support for firms engaged in risky activities, commercialising new technologies generally. So there's a double case for carbon sequestration and storage, but a case for public funding of innovation more generally in relation to the new technologies. There will be strong demands on expansion of public infrastructure associated with the transition to a low emissions economy, new patterns, stronger, more effective, more national electricity transmission grids, transportation networks for carbon dioxide for sequestration, possibly improvements of the gas pipeline infrastructure. Some of these things can be handled smoothly by markets. Many cannot, and will at least require government regulatory action, may require in the early stages public investment in network infrastructure. The discussion paper talks at some length about the potential linkages of the Australian ETS to other countries. This is a really important question. I'm not going to have time now to go into it. Maybe we could get into it in discussions. There will be some very important choices. We could simply integrate with the schemes of some other countries. And if we did that with a big country, like the European Union, we would effectively be absorbing characteristics of their scheme. We would end up taking their price. If they've got a well-structured scheme with giving an economically efficient forward price curve, we would absorb that. If they had an unstable and inefficient scheme, like Europe had for several years, we would absorb all of that. So there's judgments to be made when you're considering linking to another scheme between the undoubted advantages in reduction of the cost of abatement through spreading abatement over a large area, and compromising the integrity of our own scheme. We'll have to make those judgments case by case. The interim report pointed to some very large opportunities, probably for relatively low-cost abatement in neighbouring countries associated with management and slowing the deforestation process and encouraging associated afforestation and reafforestation. Close links with neighbouring countries could be very important to the scheme. There may end up being choices between different ways of linking overseas. We may need, at the moment, we probably would have to choose between close links with our developing country neighbours and with Europe, because Europe probably at this stage would not allow linkage with a scheme that was strongly influenced by forestry credits, which are not allowed in the in the European scheme at the moment. I'd also like to draw attention to one part of the discussion paper that hasn't received much public attention, but which I think is both interesting and important. That's section 5, where we talk a little bit about how the dynamic process of adjustment to the carbon pricing will work its way through the Australian economy. There will be a lot of strong initial reactions, and I think that once we are pricing emissions, we'll all be surprised at how widespread the emissions reducing responses to that are. In the big sector in Australia for emissions, proportionally bigger than in other countries, is the electricity sector. Stationary energy here accounting for over 50% and substantially more than 50% of expected growth in emissions. We would probably see fairly quickly changes in the balance of at least at the margin of coal and gas, and gradually see the greater use of renewable energy. There'll be some very important and complex interaction between mandatory renewable energy targets and the ETS, and we've suggested in the discussion paper that these should be analysed closely because there could be some unexpected effects in there. But I suggest you have a look if you're interested in how the scheme will actually interact with the economy in that concluding section of the paper. So the model presented in the discussion paper outlines what the review thinks are necessary measures to provide investor confidence, low-cost abatement, and domestic and international credibility in an ETS. We see simplicity and credibility as essential characteristics of an ETS that's to do the job of minimising the cost of adjustment to a low-emissions economy. There will be things to be learnt once the scheme's in operation, and I'd suggest, and in our draft report, we'll probably recommend that after a couple of years and before the deeper emissions reductions post-2012 start to take effect, we have a review of details of the scheme just to make sure that everything is operating as expected. And to get things right, to have a basis in community support for the ETS that allows stability over time in the parameters that will determine how it works, we need a robust discussion now. Let's have the discussion now about the design features we want to operate so that once we put the scheme in place, it will be stable over a long period of time. Thank you.